Hey everybody, I'm a recovered compulsive eater. My name is Gary, and first thing I said, if you've heard me speak before, I apologize. My story hasn't changed very much. It's pretty much what it was in the past. So I've been an active member of Overeaters Anonymous since August 1st of 1988. When I say active, I mean I've been pretty much in the middle of the room since my first day. What happened was I decided to commit suicide in 1988. It wasn't I made some half-hearted attempts in the past, but I had a real plan. I was definitely this was really going to happen. I was 340 pounds, just about twice the weight that I am now. I'm half the man I used to be, and more than twice as old as it was when I got here. I was 340 pounds, but that wasn't it. It was just I was so bitter and hateful, and just I couldn't stand life. I couldn't stand people. I was so angry. I couldn't go on with the amount of anger and bitterness that I had, and I didn't know that so much of that bitterness had to do with my weight, or just how right I was and how wrong everybody else was. I just, I couldn't take it. I'm a retired college professor. So in academics, the year starts in August. So like I had this plan that if nothing changed by August, I would commit suicide. Rather than going back to work, I would commit suicide. So somehow August 1st of 1988, I ended up at my first OA meeting. Things changed, things changed. And I didn't like the meeting. I didn't like the meeting at all. It was way too feminine. Even today, today OA is only 13% male. It's 87% female, at least at the last census. I think we do another one in 2 years. But then it was even more female, and it was just feminine. Like, I don't know if you know this, but one of the original logos for OA was a butterfly. And so it came into this room, and it was all butterflies and rainbows, and there was all this hugging, and the hugging. And there was a guy there at this meet. There was a guy at this meeting, an old guy named Hi, and he would say, "Hi, my name is Hi," and people would go, "Hi, hi," and then giggle. They go, "Hi, hi." Like, that was so funny. I was like, "That's your sense of humor here? Like, this is like, I don't belong with you people." But the speaker that night he became my first sponsor. He was my sponsor for 8 years, Jeff Grant. He's in the Sponsorship Hall of Fame for sponsoring me. So you might have heard of him. He became my first. He spoke about something I had never heard before. He talked about having the obsession removed. And having done pretty much every diet, like whatever. He talked about having the obsession removed, and I heard that, and I was in. I just like whatever I had to do, I was in. Because I knew then what I still know today, 37 years later, if my only chance is to have the obsession removed, that's the only shot I've got. Barring that, I'm going to binge, and I'm going to binge myself to death. So I did. He said, "Have this," and this is the truth. If this was a Charles Manson cult, and they said this is what you have to do to, if you have to pillage and do these horrible things to have the obsession removed, I would have done it. They had me. It turned out what I had to do to have the obsession removed was trust God and love my fellows. What a good thing that is. What a good thing that instead of pillaging and plundering, what I have to do is trust God and love my fellows. That works out so much better. But if I had to do horrible things, I would have. Somewhere in the big book, it says we're led to these things not by virtue, but by necessity. And that's certainly true for me. I do all these virtuous things, I really do, but not because I'm virtuous. But because they lead me to a life of sin and happy and usefulness. I mean, because they make my life work. I come from a long line of criminals and con artists. I was a criminal growing up. So left to my own devices, This isn't the life I'd be living. Left to my own devices, this certainly isn't it. So I got together with this guy and he became my sponsor. And we started working the steps. And like many of you, in the first step, I told my story. And I told, I had, it was my job to come up with proof to myself that I'm truly a compulsive eater and not just somebody with an eating problem. I had no problem admitting that I was a compulsive eater. That was like clear to me. All my life, all my life. I've gained and lost 50 pounds, 75 pounds, 100 pounds several times. There are parts of me today, like I said, I've lost half my body weight, but there are still parts of me that look like a woman who's had six or seven kids. I mean, I've got the stretch marks and stuff to prove it. My favorite first step story, I always love telling the story because it's, as a kid, like I said, I come from a long line of criminals, and my father had to leave the country because he was hiding from the federal authorities. And he was in the Caribbean hiding. And I was living in New York. I grew up in New York, and I had to leave because I was hiding from the state authorities. I was a teenager, they were going to put me in what they used to call reform school. I don't know what they call it now, but school for, bad kids, troubled youth. So they were going to put me in a school for troubled youth, and so I was living in the Caribbean with my dad, and he, it's not for me to call anybody a compulsive eater, but he displayed all the symptoms. So he was going through a phase where he wanted to lose weight, so there was no food in the house, none, and we were up in the mountains in the Caribbean. And there's, this is before DoorDash or, I don't know how people recover with DoorDash and Grubhub and that kind of stuff existing. God bless you. So we're up in the mountains and there's no food, and I'm having a carb craving, a serious craving for carbs. And I don't know about you, but when I experience a craving, it feels like a need. It feels like oxygen. It's not like just something I want. It's a craving, something I have to have. So I had a thought. And the thought was, we don't have any carbs in the house, but we have a German Shepherd. And the German Shepherd has milk bones, dog biscuits, and those are carbs. That's why, in the chapter two, The Agnostic, there are four stories, if you include the Jaywalker, and all four of them have to do with, suddenly I had a thought. The guy with lots of time said, I suffered from the belief that it all has to do with thoughts. That's why I try not to have any thoughts anymore. I don't, in all seriousness, I don't romance food thoughts at all. I don't like, I don't, anyhow. So I had this thought about the dog biscuits. My second thought was, you can't eat those. Those are disgusting. And I was right. They are. And the second one wasn't any better, nor the third, nor the fourth, nor the fifth. And the more I ate, they ain't getting any better. And here's the reason I like to tell that story, because it's a first step story. Because here's the thing, if I had any choice in the world, I would not have eaten dog biscuits. I ate those dog biscuits because I was driven by a compulsion beyond human aid. And I didn't know how to turn to God yet. I was driven by a compulsion beyond human aid. And I say this in case any of you are still left with a guilt or shame about anything you've ever done around food, to know. I sponsored a guy who weighed 700 pounds. Nobody weighs 700 pounds by choice. We're driven to this, man. It's like, it's no different than a heroin addict. I have a friend who sold her Mercedes-Benz in Overtown here in Miami. We sold her Mercedes-Benz for $300 worth of crack. No, that makes perfect sense to me. It makes perfect sense to me. No different than me eating dog biscuits. It's what we do. It's what we do. So if you got any remaining, like, we do weird stuff because we're addicts, man. That's the deal, So Jeff took me to the second step and coming to believe about God. And I was arguing with him all. I was just arguing with him. I wasn't a believer. I wasn't an atheist. I wasn't an agnostic. What I was extremely, extremely obnoxious. And I still am. 37 years later, I'm still pretty obnoxious. And I was going to argue whatever side you were on, I was going to argue the other side. And Jeff, of course, he was in recovery, so of course he believed in God. So I was explaining to him all the reasons there can't be a God, blind people, the Holocaust, all the nonsense your sponsees say to you when they're trying to convince you that there's no God. And he said something to me that was so important, I always like to pass it on to others, especially others who sponsor. He said, "I don't give a hoot what you believe." Like that. He said, "I don't give a hoot." He didn't use the word hoot. We're two guys, you get the gist of it. He said, "I don't give a hoot what you believe." He said, "So," he said, "you're an active addict. So God hasn't chosen to reveal the nature of the cosmos to you, Moses." He said it just like that. Like, who do you think you are, man? Like, who do you think you are? And he's so on the money. We think compulsive eaters are in a different category than heroin addicts or like any other. Like who would go over to a heroin addict with a needle hanging out of his arm and say, "Excuse me, Mr. Heroin Addict, tell me your theology. Is there an afterlife? Is there a God?" Jeff said, "Here's the thing. If you want to get well, come to believe this. I don't care how you come to believe it, but come to believe it. Because people who want to get well come to believe in a power greater than themselves that can restore them to sanity." He said, "If you're not willing to believe that, if you're not willing to try to believe that, it simply means that you want to eat more than you want to get well. And that's not bad. That's just compulsive eaters. That's compulsive eaters want to eat more than they want to get well. That's why you're here. If you want to get well, come to believe this." And that's what I did. In the big book, it says to face an alcoholic, to be doomed to an alcoholic death, or to face or to adopt spiritual principles is sometimes a weighty decision. Only if you're a late stage addict. If you went over to somebody with fourth stage cancer or tuberculosis, and they're in the deathbed, and you said, "Listen, I've had what you have, and I've recovered. And here's how I did it. I came to believe in the Easter Bunny. And if you want to get well the way I got well, come to believe in the Easter Bunny." They'd say, "Okay, I'll at least try. I'll give it a shot. I'll give it a shot." Only addicts go, "Well, is there a third option? Can I take one from column A and one from column B?" We talk about working the program, about working the program. I've never had to do anything for my recovery anywhere near as difficult as what I've had to do for my disease. When I was living in Brooklyn one time, I was broke, and I had a vice thing in my I was living in an animation studio, and I took pennies and filed them down to the size of dimes. It took me all day, filed them down to the size of dimes so I can get something out of a vending machine that was next door. It took me all day. I've never had to do anything like I've had to sneak down in my first marriage. My first wife, God rest her soul, and she's still my second favorite wife. I used to sneak down into her parents' basement and steal food in the middle of the night, knowing that if her father woke up, he'd come down with a gun. He'd hear that noise downstairs. I've never had to do anything like that for my recovery. Like I said, here's what I had to do. Trust God, love you. Tough work, tough work. It is hard. Don't, like, trusting God is not easy. Loving some of you is challenging. It's worth the effort. Anyhow, oh man, 15 minutes already. Third step, I turned my will. My sponsor and I would get on our knees, and I turned my will and my life over to the care of God as best I could. I still do that every day, and my life changed. The big book says that some of us are changed, have a drastic change all at once. A great effect is felt at once. I was one of those. I still get choked up about this. It's not just the grass got greener, the sky got bluer, but I had spent my whole life, like I said, I was a criminal. I spent my whole life trying to get away with what I could. Like, if you didn't see me eating this, you didn't see, it didn't count. It was just getting away with whatever I could. And just the decision to try to live my life by spiritual principles, not even doing it, just the decision to try to live my life on spiritual principles changed who I was so much. My values changed, what I looked to do. I remember that my one of the 6-step assignments was to every day to do somebody a good turn without getting found out. And I remember that what a profound effect that the attempt to do that had on me. Not just doing it, but even just the attempt to do that, to get up in the morning and think, what can I do? Just that kind of stuff just made me such a different person from who I was. So extremely selfish. When I told you I was going to commit suicide, when I was going to commit suicide, we had no money. And my wife was living in Florida. We moved to Florida where she had no family. And we had a 3-year-old daughter. She's now 40, but we had a 3-year-old daughter. And I was going to commit suicide and leave my wife with no money in a state where she had no family, with a 3-year-old girl. That's how selfish I was. Can't top that in terms of on a selfishness scale, on a selfishness scale. And now I live a life really dedicated to others. What kind of time do I have? I have like 3 minutes more. Since my understanding is that everybody here has been around a while, I just want to spend a little bit of time but talking about living in 10, 11, and 12. Because that's, really where we live. And, I do a 10, daily 10 step every morning and night throughout the day. But I do a written 10 step at night. And the 10 step, of course, sends me back to 6 and 7. When I used to think the 10 step meant like look at night and see if I stepped on anybody's toes that day. But it's not what it says. What it says is continue to take personal inventory. That is, new character defects come up in my life. Or things that, like when I came into OA, I was not a gossip. Like I said, I was a criminal. I grew up with a closed mouth. But you'll notice this if you hang out with old timers, long timers. We become gossips. We think we're talking about people like for their benefit. Like, do you think Joe's going to make it? And what about Sheila? That kind of stuff. How come? But really, we're gossips. I did. I became a gossip later on in recovery, and I had to address that. And things like that come up. Like, I have to look for new character defects and old ones that crop up. And I have to, self-righteousness, man. Oh my God. But our 10 step, like in our literature, the 10 step in the OA 12 and 12 promises permanent recovery. In the first paragraph of the 10 step and the last paragraph of the 10 step in our literature promises permanent recovery from compulsive eating. To me, that beats any promise in the big book. Permanent recovery. Because the one day at a time thing is nice, and we work the program one day at a time, but I'm not interested in being abstinent for a day. I've done that before I got to OA. I've had diets. Permanent recovery? Man, what I wouldn't do for permanent recovery. Oh man. And my relationship with God in the 11th step, as I've aged, of course, my outer life has become limited in some ways. There are things I used to, like, I've had the privilege in recovery of hiking through some of the best places in the world. I did the hike of in Region 2. I've done the hike of 6 glaciers in Lake Louise and and th throughout Nevada and anyhow, I can't do that anymore. But my inner life is richer than it's ever been. My relationship with God, the time I spent in meditation and with God, just and feeling connected to God in the universe is just remarkable. And I've always done a lot of service. I've been involved in service. Like, I was brought to my first intergroup meeting 6 months in, but I don't want to get too much into what I do, but I'm actively involved. When I said I'm an active member of Overeaters Anonymous, I've been in the center of the room for 37 years, and I remain there. And it's a great connection. It's a great way to be part of this thing and to take ownership in it, to own my seat in OA. The big book talks about self-sacrificing action. Service is frequently a pain in the ass. Oh, pain in the butt or neck. I'm sorry. Service is frequently a pain in the neck. But God, you people, and this program, have not just saved my life, you have given me a life worth living. If there's ever anything I can do to return the favor, please let me know. My phone number is in my little Hollywood Square box here. Thank you so much for letting me share.